Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Creative Processing Podcast. My name is Joe Gordon-Levitt. The idea of this show is to have a conversation about the creative process. That conversation starts with a question. New question every episode. That question comes from you out there asking those good questions on the internet. And then I find a guest, someone who I think would be really good at answering that question. And we talk about it for an hour or so, or less, or more. This week, my guest is the artist Shepard Fairey. He's probably most known for the Hope Obama poster with that incredible kind of graphic treatment. You also might know him for the Andre the Giant Has a Posse Obey campaign, which you've probably seen in any number of contexts if you've ever spent any time in any American metropolis. You've probably seen it stenciled onto various or stickered onto various signs or street corners. I grew up looking at it and always being like, what is that? Until I learned, like, oh, it's subversive art. But I think Shepard is going to be really good at answering this week's question. The question is from Shishuraj Karmalkar from Mumbai, India. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that perfectly, but I don't want to try to do a Hindi accent and fuck it up. The question is, how do you wrestle with the statement that artists are selfish since they're off worrying about their art and not devoting more energy to political rebellion in troubled times? This is definitely something I personally think about a lot. We're all, I think, perhaps more politically focused in the last few years as things have become increasingly politically polarizing. But even before that, I was brought up by parents who were fairly politically active, politically aware, and was always sort of taught to consider that and definitely always wondered, well, am I doing my part? Am I helping at all by telling stories, making movies? It's a valid question. And I thought Shepard Fairey would be excellent at answering the question because his art tends to be, it's not exclusively so, but tends to be rather political in nature. I know y'all out there might not be tuning into this show to hear a conversation about politics. This is a show about the creative process. However, I think in certain respects, it's hard to divorce the two. And this is what we get into. So here's the intersection of where art meets politics. Shepard Fairey. Shepard Fairey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for being here, man.
Thanks, Joe. Happy to be here.
Okay, so as I told you before, the idea is to have one question about the creative process and then spawn a litany of tangents around a conversation from that one question. But I thought you'd be good for this question. It comes from Mumbai, India. The guy's name is Shishuraj Karmalkar. Here's the question. How do you wrestle with the statement that artists are selfish since they're off worrying about their art and not devoting more energy to political rebellion in troubled times? So I'll just give you first crack at that, and then we'll go from there.
I mean, luckily, this is something I've considered quite a bit.
Yeah.
So I feel prepared for this question.
I thought you might.
And I do agree that artists are very fortunate that they have the luxury of dabbling in what a lot of people would consider to be maybe superficial or self-absorbed. But what I think is that art has the ability to connect with people, and everyone gets to connect with it in their own way. That's very special, that it's got a very personal thing and a universal thing to it. Mm-hmm. But you can also address things that matter in the world with art, and that's my strategy. I don't speak for all artists, but I understand how fortunate I am to get to make pictures for a living.
Yeah.
So I treat it like I've seen other artists I admire treat it. And a lot of those artists come from the music space, not the visual art space.
Uh-huh.
People like Bob Marley or Bob Dylan, Joe Strummer from The Clash, mm-hmm. Chuck D from Public Enemy, using their medium to say something and create enjoyable content, entertainment, however you want to put it. that's what I'm trying to do with my visual art. And not only am I trying to highlight social and political topics with my art that I think need to be addressed, I'm also using the revenue from my art to contribute to the people who are doing the work on the ground that moves the needle on an issue. What I've tried to do is take my self-absorbed artist's nature and find a way to channel that constructively. Because I acknowledge that the thing about art is I can spend hours and hours and like no one else matters. I might eventually realize I'm hungry or have to go to the bathroom. Uh-huh. But time just disappears when I'm in the zone trying to solve a problem. And it's amazing therapy for me. I'm lucky to have it.
Do you think when you follow those selfish, one could use the word selfish, urges, that it actually makes the work more impactful?
In one sense, which is that I don't think I'm that different or special. And so if it's giving me a feeling, a good feeling, a feeling that I've achieved something, that it's something I would want to look at, which is in a way very selfish, then I think that's a feeling I can trust that other people might get the same reaction from it. Now, not everyone's the same. So obviously that's, you know, not going to be perfectly consistent, but in a weird way, my gut, which nothing could really be more selfish than your gut on a lot of things, has served me well in creating things that other people can connect with.
So then do you think that artists are a necessary part of how it all works, how a society works, how a democracy, you could say, works? Like, do you think that art needs to be there in order for it to function right?
I really can't imagine a world without it, so I guess, yeah, I'd say it's pretty important. But to me, creativity in the art space, and you know, there's so many different realms where I think there's creativity. There's a lot of creativity in science.
Yes.
But creativity through the arts, I think a lot of people see it as a way to sort of manifest the human condition, which humans are social. We want to have sometimes not vulnerable conversations directly, but we want to have conversations that share what we feel and who we are. Yeah. And art is a way to do that without having to say, man, I need therapy. My life's not great.
Let me go see a scientist.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's, well, you know, that psychology, there's science and maybe some art mixed together.
Maybe,
right there.
Yeah, right. No, I'm keying in on you mentioning that there's creativity in science, and because the difference between art and science is something that fascinates me. And when I think of this question of, is it selfish for an artist to do art, especially in times of, you know, political polarization, et cetera? I do think about the role of art in kind of where we've arrived at today. Mm-hmm. And it kind of pains me to say it sometimes because I consider myself an artist most days and love creativity, love storytelling. And yet right now, sometimes I feel like that's the problem. Like, our politics is too influenced by art and storytelling and not influenced enough by logic, reason, science, you know, the kind of the cold hard facts that is not really the domain of artists, if you will. Like, I think our current president is probably a really incompetent government leader, but he's an effective storyteller, at least to his audience, such that he was, you know, able to win an election. And like, are we paying too much attention? Are we giving too much power to artists, I guess, in our politics, in our government?
I hadn't really thought of it that way. Trump, the Picasso of hate, fear, and division.
Yeah.
I mean, Hitler was a failed artist.
Actually, I mean, Hitler, the Nazi regime had an incredible propaganda department and pioneered all kinds of filmmaking techniques. Like, if you go back and watch have you ever seen Lenny Riefenstahl, exactly. Yeah. They're incredible films, especially for their time. Yeah.
Really beautiful. Yeah, the celebration of the human form and perfection and lighting and I do think that people are seduced by things like that. Now, I maybe wrongly believe that most artists in creating have to connect with a side of their humanity that makes them more compassionate, more empathetic, mm-hmm. because there's something in sharing a part of yourself that I think makes you relate to others. Now, there is propaganda that's coming from a more clinical standpoint. We've analyzed what humans' trigger points are. This mm-hmm. is how we manipulate them.
Right.
But I don't think that most art is about that. What I'm trying to do with a lot of my art is actually, you know, combat the easy tactics of, you know, creating a narrative around scapegoating immigrants or, you know, fearing people that don't have the same religion you do or whatever. And trying to find something to say, this is shared humanity. We have a lot more in common than what divide us, set us apart. And you know, and push back. But I acknowledge that what I'm doing in a way is what I would consider positive propaganda versus, you know, negative propaganda.
Propaganda is a word you use a lot in your work.
Yeah, I do. And it's because I want to be transparent that any image with an agenda, which is actually most images, is a form of propaganda. It's just whether you try to hide that fact or whether you're honest about it. I want to say, this is where I'm coming from. This is to start a conversation about this and you make up your own mind. Where a lot of propaganda is like, your mind is made up for you and this should seal the deal.
Sure. Well, and it does exactly the opposite of admitting to be propaganda.
Exactly.
Like when you have, what's O'Reilly's thing? The no spin zone. Like, yeah, okay, you're not, but everything is spun. Everything is coming from a perspective, from an agenda. But yeah, the calling something, or what is it, fair and balanced? Fox calls itself fair and balanced.
It's
like, oh no, this is just objective truth. There's no art here. It's not propaganda. Whereas what you're saying is be upfront about the fact that, yeah, you're communicating an agenda.
Exactly. And I hadn't heard the term until, I guess, maybe 2015 or so, but really the rise of Trump's rhetoric and his ilk, but how they'd figured out that through social media research, you know, the phenomenon of you know, confirmation bias, that people end up wanting to curate their news and their, you know, their opinions based on backing up what they already believe, like lawyers for themselves.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think what's happened is that there are a lot of people who have figured out how to harness that tendency within people. With my art, I'm trying to do something different. That's all I can say.
Yeah. So do you have a different definition for art versus propaganda? What's the difference?
I think it's very muddy, actually. People ask me, they say, well, what's your, you know, your definition between design and art? Well, design, a lot of people think, is an aesthetic, that something is not painterly, it's crisp and graphic, and that makes it design. But Robert Indiana's work, a lot of Andy Warhol's work, a lot of Jasper John's work, a lot of, you know, Barbara Kruger, they're all considered artists, but their work is very design aesthetic heavy.
Right.
And I think intent is what makes something art rather than design. And something that could be considered propaganda in a sense and design in a sense can also be art if the creator's intention is for it to have latitude for interpretation that gives some freedom and respect and, you know, interpretive abilities to the viewer, that it's work that creates a conversation rather than saying, this is the end of the conversation, agree with me or you're wrong.
Right. So you're almost inviting the audience of the art to participate in a creative process and make their own meaning out of the art, that's art versus propaganda. You're trying to just manipulate them into feeling one way.
Okay, so here's the desired end result in terms of how it's going to shift their views and get them to behave the way you want. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, with my work, what I view all the time is that, okay, somehow they've been told, look over here, don't look over here. And I'm like, please, please take a second to look over here. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it's up to you.
Okay. So can you apply that then to, so your iconic signature sort of logo, if you will, the Obey Andre the Giant thing.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? Because what you just said invoked the whole Obey image to me of like, take a second to look over here, not only in the image itself, but also in where you put the image, the fact that it's not hung in galleries, or I guess maybe nowadays it is, but that it didn't start as something that was hung in galleries. And even today, even though you do galleries, I still see the fucking Andre the Giant eyes all over this city. Can you just talk about like, what are the politics, or like, what is the agenda or the propaganda or the intent behind that Obey image?
Sure. Well, I started in 1989, 30 years ago, can you believe it, with this sticker of Andre the Giant that I just made. I was trying to teach a friend how to make a stencil, and he got frustrated, so I finished it, and I said, oh, yeah, this is going to be our new crew, our new posse, the Andre posse, and I went and I made some stickers and gave them to my skateboard friends and put some around at some spots in Providence, Rhode Island, where I was living, and next thing you know, people were asking me like, hey man, I heard you're the guy with the stickers. Can I get some Andre stickers? It was like a secret handshake. Uh-huh. And then beyond that, I was really only putting them in the places where I thought my peers, the people that thought like me, that were part of my culture, would notice them. So at skate spots, on stop signs, at some of the music venues. But it was resonating with other people. And what I realized was that this sticker was intriguing people. One, because Andre the Giant is intriguing, but two, because it was just showing up in random spots and why? And people were asking, why is it there? And I realized people are so conditioned to just being confronted with advertising and government signage that something that's a little disruptive, it's like, you know, some people it made mad. It was like weeds growing up through the sidewalk. Like, why hasn't this sidewalk been manicured? Yeah. And other people thought it was a great sign of, you know, something bubbling underground. And I thought, this is fascinating. I'm going to push this further. And then I started to add, after seeing John Carpenter's movie, They Live, I started to add the Obey into it. And the reason I wanted to evolve away from a wrestling reference, because really what I was about getting people to question things. And that's been sort of my mantra all along, is question everything.
Was that the intent when you first started making the sticker, or that then evolved after it had started to catch on?
No, there was no big, you know, a philosophical reason for making it originally. It was sort of just a quick inside joke with some friends, because everything in skateboarding was, okay, that band has more than 50 followers. They sold out. We got to move to the next more exclusive thing. And so,
and you're talking about followers, by the way, way before social media, quote unquote, followers.
Yeah, I'm talking about
people that show up at a show.
Yeah. And what? They made like 20 cassettes. Right. They totally sold out.
Yeah.
So it started off as just me doing all the sort of obnoxious things that 19-year-old skateboarders do. But then I did love the Dead Kennedys and Orwell and Ray Bradbury, all these, you know, influences I had that were looking at the toxic side of the status quo, is the way I would put it.
Uh-huh.
And so there was an intuitive part of it where I wanted to be disruptive, but just sort of because I'm a prankster and I like to mess with people. But then I saw an opportunity to evolve it in a way that I thought was more profound. And also, you know, you were talking about ego and self-absorption.
Right.
At first, when I was making the stickers, going to an art school, Rhode Island School of Design, that's an excellent school with, I thought I had really barely the goods to get into the school. Nothing was great was ever going to happen for me. It was very intimidating. Everything had ever already been done. But doing the sticker was just like one way for me to say, hey, I exist and this is what I demonstrate it with. You know, it was very very primitive in a way. But then I decided I wanted to, as I started to develop my identity as an artist, I wanted to evolve it in a direction that still had that sense of mischief, but was a little bit more serious. And using the word obey seemed like the, you know, the most provocative, powerful thing I could do, because I consider blind obedience to be one of the biggest problems we have in society. But right. blind obedience comes from people wanting to be liked, not wanting to step out of line and be judged and criticized. And then, you know, and that's a very subconscious thing. And there's, you know, not wanting to get in trouble for breaking laws or breaking rules. But how many times have you heard, well, that's just not the way it's done. You know, here's what people do. My parents would always say stuff like that to me.
Yeah.
But the idea of making obedience not something sort of, you know, in the ether, but something concrete that you had to make a choice about, like, am I busting through this, going around it, submitting to it? So using the word obey in the work, that was rendering it in a way that people had to deal with consciously.
This is fascinating because, so the original question is it selfish to make art in politically troubled times? And here you're talking about this thing which originated from what I understand, like the way you just told it, it sounded like there is something selfish about the original action of doing the sticker. You said it was like, well, it's sort of this inside joke, or it was a way for me to feel like I was something, sort of solidify my own identity to myself. And then it evolved mm-hmm. into, as you just put it, you're saying what you wanted to say about one of the things that you think is the most important patterns in society of sort of blind obedience, like you say. So it sort of did both. It started out selfish yeah. and then ended up something beyond that.
It still has that. There's an aspect of my ego. Every time I put up a sticker, it's probably not that much more advanced than like a dog peeing on a fire hydrant.
You still put up stickers.
Yeah, all the time. But I like to think that I'm channeling that impulse in a way that also has, you know, has some constructive benefit for, you know, for society. And not everyone agrees, but you know, some people are like, hey, you know, you're a troublemaker, you're a vandal. And, you know, everyone's entitled to their opinion, but in a lot of ways that fear of stepping outside the lines that I think those reactions represent is exactly what I'm protesting in the first place. So
right.
it does not dissuade me.
Yeah, no. Well, clearly not. You've been doing it for a while.
When equipment breaks down and operations come to a halt, every single second counts. So why is your maintenance team spending 60% of their time doing anything but turning wrenches? Maintain X is the AI-powered maintenance and asset management system that helps your team get back to actually fixing breakdowns. No more searching for manuals. No more hunting down parts. No more drowning in paperwork. With Maintain X, your team can access manuals from anywhere, create new procedures in minutes, and turn voice notes into clear and complete work order feedback. What used to take hours now only takes minutes. Keep your operations moving and your wrenches turning. Join over 13,000 maintenance teams that are already fixing more and filing less. Try Maintain X for free today. Go to maintainx.com/AI. That's maintain and the letter x.com/AI.
Okay, so then if we're going to talk about art being political and not being selfish, you have to then think about, well, what is the impact that it's having? And I imagine this is something you think about. If you are thinking of your work and your creativity in political terms, you must be thinking like, okay, well, is it working? Like, am I having the impact that I want to be having? How can I tell? How do you think about that?
Well, some things are easier to tell than others. For example, when I did the Hope poster for Obama,
yep.
that went viral so quickly, I realized, you know, this is making a difference in terms of how people can visually represent their support for Obama.
Right.
I mean, the great thing about the Hope poster was it was standing on the shoulders of all the tremendous inspiration that Obama was providing people. Mm-hmm. And he had a great campaign logo. But the portrait that has a humanity mixed with a sort of heroic symbolism, mm-hmm. there wasn't anything that existed at the time that was filling that need.
Right. I remember it when it came out. It was like that just – it did. It evoked a feeling. It summed it right up in one instant when you saw that image. And only – art can really do that. That doesn't come from facts or arguments or, you know, more long form communication. That can just come from art. I guess that's the power of it.
My assumption at the time was that other people are inspired by this guy, but the Bush years made a lot of people very cynical. So how do you crystallize those feelings of, you know, hope, like it says in the poster? And and then, you know, when people are hopeless, they don't act. When they do have hope, it's much more likely to motivate them to act. So, I'm really happy that worked. And then when Trump was elected and it was all about fear and division and so many things that to me seemed un-American, I worked on the series We the People, which same color palette as the Hope poster, but with people who weren't famous as the subjects, just the groups that had been most disparaged. So an African-American, a Latina, and a Muslim woman, with some copywriting that was developed by a friend of mine that I, of course, weighed in on and agreed with. But, you know, we the people defend dignity. We the people support each other, and we the people are greater than fear. Mm-hmm. I thought, these are not going to go over that well. This is a time when everyone's about identity politics and their own little tribe, and not about unity, not about, you know, common humanity. But those things went crazy, viral. So, you know, there's no way for me to predict what's going to work other than this feels like the need right now.
Right.
And so, you know, I did that. And not everything works as well as those images. But even though looking at social media comments can be so depressing, I do it anyway, at least, you know, sometimes, so that I do feel like I have a dialogue with the public, and that when people, you know, anonymously without a filter, you know, feel like they can say whatever they want, a lot of times it's really mean, but sometimes it's meaningful. And sometimes it's there's an insight that I didn't expect. And I think that's very useful.
But I guess, you know, the question that I asked was, how do you know if you're making an impact? And social media is one way of measuring that impact.
Well, seeing stuff in the real world, too. When I make free downloads of my images and they show up at March for Our Lives, at you know, at the Women's March,
Seeing those images. I went to the Women's March in L.A., and I remember the one that you're talking about. I don't remember the woman's name, but the Muslim woman that you gave that, like, the Hope poster treatment to, and a lot of people were holding that up.
But that's the point. She didn't have to be somebody known. She was an archetype that could be anyone. And when we're dealing with celebrity being such an important part of currency, of value, that people took these symbols and thought they were valuable without it being a Kardashian, that was amazing.
It's funny you bring up, like, okay, but what about the real world? Because I sometimes do wonder, you can count likes or things, retweets or whatever, on social media and think, this is making a difference. I'm having an impact on the world, or someone is having an impact on the world. And sometimes I wonder, is that a bit of an illusion? Like, it seems like an impact because it's making the numbers go up on a certain platform, but what impact is it really, really having? I guess when it comes to then a popular election, if it's helping bring out the vote or something. But you're
right. How can you measure what degree of efficacy it has? Because you'll see something, some viral video, and be, you know, like, oh, you know, the media studies person said it got 80 million impressions and blah, you know, and I never even know exactly what that means. But when an election is lost by 50,000 votes, you know, you think, well, that one video should have won the election. but it is hard to know. And I, as much as I use all these tools, I like to get out in the real world and do things. I like to paint murals in public. I like to do other street art. I still love to see, you know, a rally where human beings congregate and there's molecules colliding. I think the more we live our lives inside our you know, our phones and our computers, you know, the more maybe desensitized we are to what's meaningful about human connection. So it's because the thing I like about what I do, I don't mean like what I think's great about it. I mean, for me, I get to create in solitude and work through a problem. It's very therapeutic. And then I share it a number of different ways. I'm going to share it online, but I'm also going to make prints. I'm going to make stickers. I'm going to make t-shirts. And I'm probably going to paint a mural where I'm out in the street and someone comes around a corner and they go, whoa.
Yeah.
That wasn't here yesterday. Like, how long have you been working on this? Yeah. What's the story? And you can see just how emotional it is for them.
For sure.
It's very visceral. And yeah, I think that even when you're going through some of the most amazing videos and images on your phone, it doesn't elicit the same kind of reaction.
No, for sure. I don't think I've seen you since. I remember encountering a big mural of yours in downtown New York City on like Houston Street and maybe Allen or something like that. I don't know if
Bowery.
Bowery, yeah, Bowery.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And having, yeah, when something is so big, just physically big, it's like you say, it's so different than we're so conditioned now to seeing everything the size of our phone.
Yeah.
It's powerful. It's really powerful. But I want to get to, so you started talking a bit about making stuff, and I want to make sure I have time to ask you like about that, about your actual process. So, and in terms of the question of doing art in politically charged times,
mm-hmm.
tell me about how you approach making something. I imagine there's a case by case basis to some degree, but like, are you considering a message at the outset? Are you considering like the aesthetic at the outset? Like, are you considering the audience? Who's this for? Like, what are the things that are on your mind when you're first starting to make something?
It's all of those things, and it can start from any number of places. Sometimes it's something simple like a song lyric. You know, I've done a lot of stuff around the environment, and I've loved the Rolling Stones for years, but one day I was just listening to the Rolling Stones and the song Paint It Black, and I thought, you know, oil-based paint is black, oil is black. I'm just going to make a piece making, you know, I see the green earth and I want to paint it black. And then that evolved into two different solutions, but I was like, that's the copy that I want in this, and now I'm going to figure out how to render it.
Mm.
You know, one of the versions is a hand holding a paint can with sort of almost a like a Russian constructivist style angular background, but it looks like a mixture between an old paint ad and a piece of Russian propaganda. But it's you know, it says you know, black oil-based policy and you know, the most luxurious black while supplies last, you know. Uh-huh. Like all these things that are taking what you would normally see in packaging or ad copy and then making them have a double read for oil's impact on the environment. And you know, figuring out how to have that pop art sensibility, that connection to music, the environmental thing, and you know, and then my love of Russian constructivist propaganda all merge and not compete but be harmonious. Like, that's such a fun problem to solve. It started with a song lyric, but then it went to, you know, all these other things I'm interested in. How am I gonna throw that into the batter? You know what I mean?
Right. So there wasn't necessarily a linear sequence to how you were doing it. It's sort of a lot of stuff floating around in your head that kind of collides.
A lot of the things I do, they'll have a linear stretch and then it goes nonlinear because I hit a wall in terms of how to get to an ideal solution. So I moved to another project, and a lot of times when I move to the other project, the solution for the thing I was stuck on comes out of trying to solve that problem.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, I find that when I'm getting closer to the finish line on a piece, that like the number of things I'm trying goes down a narrower and narrower tunnel, really.
Yeah.
So sometimes going to a new thing, you know, it expands the lens again. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that tends to work pretty well for me. But, You know, other times I'll see a movie, I'll read a newspaper article, I'll see a piece of art that's, you know, old or new that isn't anything like what I do, but it sparks an idea that I'm going to just solve with my sensibility. And so it can come from so many different places. I just try to be really receptive and stay stimulated. And you know, sometimes I'm watching the news and I think, yeah, there's like 10 pieces that I could do based on just all the horrific things that I saw on the news today. But then I have to take a breath and decide what's really worth it, because I'm also frequently looking at how to deal with what's topical but maybe isn't going to seem outdated in a week.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's that struggle.
When you ask yourself what's worth it, are you thinking what's worth it for in terms of what kind of impact you can make? Or are you thinking what's worth it in terms of what's going to yield like some really beautiful art? Or is
money,
it both? Or
money, that's it.
Yeah, sure. Yes.
All money.
Like, how can I?
Yeah, what's gonna move units?
Yeah.
No, it's a combination of all those things. Here's an example of something that an idea I had that I never finished because I couldn't think of how to make it visually appealing. You know, I was horrified by all the drone strikes that were called signature strikes, where you don't even know who you're exactly getting, but they're exhibiting behaviors that are part of a pattern that would loosely lump you into the enemy combatant category. And a lot of times that's like teenage couriers and people like that. And, you know, in the armed forces, you know, the most shameful thing is a dishonorable discharge.
Yeah.
And, you know, I considered a lot of the drone attacks to be dishonorable discharge. Mm-hmm. So I was going to do a drone firing and some copy dishonorable discharge. But then I thought, you know what? I can't think how to make this appealing. It's only depressing.
Right.
So, you know, there you go. I'm walking you all through my creative process. And caller 10 if you've got a good solution.
To make a drone and dishonorable discharge uplifting.
But understand that any suggestions become property of Joe and Shepard.
Well, how about like someone else? How someone else? You're talking about like, is it depressing or can it be uplifting? Do you ever have moments where you're like, geez, I meant this to be interpreted one way, or I meant this to impact people one way, and it's having a different impact than what I anticipated?
Yeah, that happens sometimes. I grew up in the South, and I actually grew up, duck hunting with my dad and quail hunting with my dad. I feel sorry for animals. So I always had, I enjoyed the bonding with my dad because it was one of the few things he was really passionate about sharing with me.
Yeah.
But I just think that gun culture is terrifying for the most part. And the hypocrisy between, thou shalt not kill and a lot of Christian values and, and people's obsession with guns just seemed very contradictory to me. So I did a piece that said it had an assault rifle, and it said America, the land where God saves and Satan invests in assault rifles and high capacity magazines.
Uh-huh.
And
it made me smile, so it's not purely depressing.
Yeah. So, but what I found out was that a lot of my audience are gun lovers, and they were so angry with me, and I got so much vitriol from that. And I, you know, and then other people were saying, so you're saying if you're Christian and you have a gun that you really are a Satan lover? And and I thought, well, this thing, I don't think it's that complicated to break down rationally, but this isn't a rational issue.
Yeah.
Attachment to guns is an emotional issue. And I didn't mean to just, trigger and alienate a huge number of people with the gun stuff. I'm very frustrated by all the mass shootings and everything. But I guess what I'm getting to is that I realized that maybe that print wasn't the best way to talk about that issue.
Because it was further polarizing, and then you're just kind of preaching to the choir as opposed to reaching across.
Yeah. And you know, talking about people's, religion in a way that's sort of disrespectful, even if, in my opinion, they're disrespecting the tenets of the religion themselves, mm-hmm. it's still not helpful.
Yeah.
Nerds. Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Personal finance can feel like a pop quiz you didn't study for. This podcast is your study guide. On NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast, you'll hear from trusted journalists who explain the why behind major financial decisions. You'll get research-backed insights and clear pros and cons, whether you're planning a big purchase or just want to grow your wealth. Make your next financial move with confidence. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app.
That's really interesting, because it does seem like, and this goes back to one of the things I said earlier about is there too much art in politics? Because it does seem like, in a way, what art is best at is getting a lot of people who already feel a certain way to feel even more strongly that way. Like when you go to a concert and everyone in the crowd is like really into that band, you're all just so feeling it. Like, yeah. You're not gonna enter a debate into whether or not, like, you know, you like this song or like, that's a concert's not the place for that. And I wonder, is art polarizing in that way?
Well, yeah, I went to art school, so yeah, art is extremely polarizing. You know, oh my God, Warhol. He was such a hack. Oh my God, he's the most brilliant marketer, best artist, working with the metabolism of our culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're going to hear from even people who agree on most things a lot of contentious debates about art. And but I don't know whether art is really contributing to polarization. I mean, it's interesting how people latch on to symbols and the kind of meme culture that you could say it's art and design based in a sense. Mm-hmm. Remember the Joker, it was the Joker makeup on Obama, but it said socialism.
Oh, no.
That became a right-wing meme, and it's using a pop culture reference and, you know, comparing Obama to the Joker and mm-hmm. Not calling Obama a socialist, but saying that basically he is socialism.
Yeah.
It's like, if this germ replicates, yeah. There's more socialism. So I had a lot of issues with that one, just because, you know, I thought it was not well done, racist, inaccurate about his economic policies.
Yeah.
You know, Obama was plenty a capitalist.
Indeed.
Which I'm not saying is necessarily a good thing. But yeah, I mean, you could say that's art, but it's more like a visual wisecrack.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether that's qualifies as art.
Uh-huh.
But I've made plenty of visual wisecracks myself.
Yeah, so. You said the Obey like thing kind of started that way.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, that's part of the debate, I guess. I maybe one of the reasons I'm reluctant to say that art is part of the problem is that I have such a strong faith in art as a healing tool.
Yeah, okay. Say more about that.
I do stuff around incarceration reform. When you introduce art and music into prison programs, mm-hmm. the recidivism rate drops in half. That means your likelihood to be arrested again and be reincarcerated.
Is that right? Drops in
yeah,
half.
Yeah, drops in
when,
half.
When prisoners 50%. Get to do art and music.
And I think it's because when people find an outlet to express their feelings, their frustrations, their aspirations, they don't behave as badly because, I mean, how often have you felt frustrated that you were painted into a corner and like, man, I'm going to blow. Like, this sucks that I feel like I don't have, there's no way out of this. And a lot of people, I almost never feel like that because of where I am in my career and all the fortunate things that I've built for myself. But there were many years of my life where I was, first 10 years of my art career, I was living, you know, hand to mouth, poverty level, always frustrated that I was either going to have to ask my landlord for an extension or not pay my, the heating bill or the phone bill. And, you know, there were some times where I felt like I could enter a falling down situation where I just leave my car in traffic on the 405 and go nuts. And art has been an amazing way for me to combat those kinds of feelings. Even then, when I was feeling quite depressed and you know, desperate. Yeah. So I think it's good for a lot of people.
I very much agree. So I'll unpack this a bit more because I'm fascinated about this, and I'll you know, tip my hand to say, of course, I don't want to think that art is the problem, and I tend to like to believe that art or creativity can be part of the solution. But there is a difference between the art we were just talking about as potentially contributing to polarization versus the art you were just talking about that can be so healing. And the difference I see is one has to do with the kind of the results of the art, and one has to do with the process of the art, that it's healing for somebody to engage in a creative process. It's healing for a prisoner to play music or to paint or whatever, that recidivism goes down, or it's, you were describing art for yourself being a place of comfort in stressful times in your life. And I've definitely experienced that myself. And I, like you, I think I've been lucky to not experience terrible adversity in my life. I've had one or two, you know, bad, really bad moments, but in those times, being able to be creative and express myself has, I have found, been really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Not because of what I made, but mm-hmm. just because mm-hmm. of sort of the act of making it.
Yeah.
So let's set aside for a second the healing power of doing art and just talk for a second about, okay, but the art itself, especially politically charged art, something that is saying, here's an agenda, this candidate is good, or this policy is good, or this candidate is bad, or this policy is bad, or this ideology is good or bad, etc. Are those works of art, can they be helpful?
I think they can be. I think that understanding the power of art can enable someone to be a manipulator. You know that a lot of the people who have been advising the Trump team are people from Fox News. I don't know whether you've watched The Loudest Voice.
I want to. It's just recommended to me.
Yeah, but understanding political theater and how many people want to feel aggrieved, so you give them sources of their grievances to for them to be angry about, and you know, as a supposed newscaster, but basically just a
storyteller,
a storyteller, an orator. You know, knowing what your audience wants to hear and just giving them that.
Yeah,
that you could say that's an art form.
That maybe that's why I'm asking this. Is it feel like when I look at politicians up on stage doing a debate or giving a speech or whatever, I think to myself, that's basically what I do. It looks just like what I do. They're giving a performance. They have a script and they're trying to get their audience to feel something. And is that how we should be deciding what our government does and what our policies are, is like through these stories that these performers are delivering? Like, is that what we ought to be doing?
Well, that's a big question. My wife and I did an initiative called Make America Smart Again, which was, you know, subverting Make America Great Again to ask people to, one, vote, but two, research the issues in a meaningful way that impact them so that they can vote responsibly. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people want to watch the, you know, the debates and the charisma of the candidate and whether they had a snappy answer or sent a clever tweet. And that's what they're going to make their decision based on, and not research anything deeper. And to get back to your original question of how art can be a factor in the degradation of our democracy and the division of people, I think that if art packages a lazy answer or a talking point, and then people are like now having an even more viral, easily transmittable version of my lazy take on everything.
Right.
I don't think that's helpful.
Right.
I agree. But I think that that's also maybe just a symptom of something deeper fundamentally. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know whether those types of pieces of art are contributing to that shallowness or that laziness, or whether they are popular as a result,
right,
of the shallowness and laziness.
Yeah, I do.
And you know, when I made, for example, when I made the Obama Hope poster, I put it on my website, free download. I did a Q&A with a blog, which I then reposted to give some quick explanation of why I was supporting Obama. And I said, but don't take my word for it and don't just agree with me if you like the image. Here's Obama's website.
Yeah.
Here's some of his speeches. Go check it out for yourself. Make up your own mind.
Yeah.
That's where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to do, what I'm trying to say is, here's my disclaimer.
Yeah.
Is that, yes, I'm making things that I understand work with the nature of how people communicate and how they decide within a blink of an eye whether they are going to look at something any further or whether they're going to turn away and move to the next thing. They're being assaulted by thousands and thousands of images a day. So I've got to work within with that understanding. But that I don't want that to be the end of it. I want my works to try to push people to look into things rather than say, here's the easy way to package it and make it a signifier for who I am, and then that's it.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't sound selfish at all. that to me, that kind of gets back to that's an answer to the question. Like, especially if your intent is, hey, I'm gonna make this art that's gonna grab your attention, it's gonna make you feel something in an instant, because that's the power that art has. But hopefully I'm gonna then channel that feeling into, hey, do something more. Don't just be satisfied with this momentary emotion that the art provided you. Look into it, use your brain, do some reading. Like, check yourself.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that's the goal. And I know that it only happens, you know, maybe just a fraction of the times, but that still is better than me doing nothing. I can feel like it's worthwhile. And yeah, I have to, because otherwise I'd feel like my existence was meaningless.
Yeah. And it can't be that. All right. I feel good about us answering this question. I want to ask you one more thing. I've been doing at the end of these conversations, because the initial question comes from someone out there on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
We get a lot of good questions that can spawn an entire conversation like this. We also get some weird questions, and it can be a fun way to wrap up the episode. I'm just ask you, are you down to answer a weird question?
Sure.
All right. So this question is from Jeffrey K. Howard from Las Vegas, Nevada. Can God create a boulder so big he can't lift it?
You know, I first of all, I'm agnostic, so there's that. But then, you ever seen the movie Dodgeball?
No, I remember it.
Yeah, it's Ben Stiller and Vince Vaughn, and okay. It's about dodgeball. But Jason Bateman has this really funny part where he's playing a doofus sort of Alterna Sports bro caster, you
okay.
know, and there might be a disqualification for them not having enough players on their dodgeball team, one of the commentators says, if they don't get their other player in, they're gonna have to forfeit. And Jason Bateman goes, forfeiture, that's a bold strategy. Let's see how it plays out for them.
Uh-huh.
So anytime something is a bad idea, I always say it's a bold strategy. And if it's an even worse idea, it's a bolder strategy.
A bolder.
So, yeah, there we go. God had an even bolder strategy.
That was not the answer I expected. Nice, man. Chef Prepared, thank you so much for doing this, dude.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
All right. And that is our show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks to our guest, Shepherd Fairey. Thanks to the folks who asked this week's questions. Shishuraj Karmalkar, he goes on the internet at SK is Calvin. And Jeffrey K. Howard, who goes by at Vegas Film Critic. You can get your questions in either email creativeprocessing@hitrecord.org or right on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, use the creative processing hashtag. And if you're interested in diving deeper, making some art about any of the topics that we were talking about today, check out Hit Record. Go to hitrecord.org/creativeprocessing. We'll be collaborating on all kinds of various creative endeavors inspired by today's conversation. The producers of the Creative Processing Podcast are Raymond Way, Lexi Tinkersley, audio produced by Kier Schmidt. Thanks to Cadence 13 and everyone at the Hit Record office. And thanks again to you for listening. See you next week.